Preface. I cannot refrain from believing that America will one day become the first maritime power of the globe. They are born to rule the seas, as the Romans were to conquer the world. Alexis Tocqueville, 1835. Few American presidents cast as large a shadow on the era in which they lived as Andrew Jackson. Even today, in the 21st century, Jackson remains a popular topic for historians. Why, then, another book about the 1830s? This book is not about Jackson the president, nor is it about Jackson the individual. Although he remains a popular subject, there are sufficient biographies and studies by those who have spent their entire careers devoted to research and understanding Jackson that this author would simply have been one among many who undertook that enterprise. But with all the books about his presidency, none have addressed the subject in which this author is interested, the role of the Navy, during his 8 years as the nation's chief executive. What was the Navy's role in the 1830s under Jackson? This work studies the Navy under the prism of the Jackson presidency. At times, Jackson is omnipresent, as with the courts-martial or ordering ships on missions. At other times, he is absent. And yet at others, such as major operations, he set a clear and concise strategy, trusting ship, and squadron operations to Navy leadership. If the author is to be frank, Jackson was never a particularly favored subject of study as a person or a president. Early on in my research, I mentioned this to a professor in England who reminded me that one of the Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery's biographers felt the same way but was told to remember he was a great man. The word great is open to interpretation and various definitions, and so it is with Jackson. Jackson personifies an era of American history, good, bad, and ugly. He is a complex individual. While I still have a somewhat jaundiced view of Jackson's behavior, it is his complexity that makes him a perennially compelling subject, worthy of discussion and debate in the ever-changing rear-view mirrors of historical study. This work is the first major rear-view of the Navy during Jackson's presidency. But this author neither hopes nor expects that it will be the last. We have, in history, witnessed the dangers of monolithic thinking. Our profession and our collective understanding of history benefit from civil debates. I look forward to those who disagree with the conclusions in this work and know that I will learn from their research and perspectives as I hope my research will inform readers, just as I hope that the legacy of the late Dr. Robert Remini allows me to respectfully find an absence in his work. I am indebted to the historians who inspired this work. Daniel Walker Howe, whom I have not met, wrote a magnificent book, What Hath God Wrought? The Transformation of America, 1815 to 1848, for which he rightfully won the Pulitzer Prize in 2007. The book was a tour de force of a rapidly changing nation discussing cultural changes, religion, and the Army's activities as it supported the country's push to the Pacific. But, as a naval officer, I was curious why there was no mention of the first naval squadrons to permanently station on distant waters in support of America's growing trade. 2 years after reading Howe's book, I had the opportunity to interview Robert Remini, who had no peer as a Jackson biographer and the great statesman of that era, given the number of works he produced in his fortunately lengthy career. We met for about an hour in his office when he served as historian of the House of Representatives. Dr. Remini was a giant in his field, but his humility, kindness, and decency made this man truly great. I asked him a simple question. What did Jackson think of the Navy? His response was concise. He didn't like it. He didn't understand it, and he didn't use it. He had a clear view when he explained Jackson's relationship with the Navy, but it was a clarity born of an absence of research on the matter. In his decades of study, he had not gone through the primary sources about the Navy or discussed it. While I could not quantify the first statement, I could explore the last two, and so began my journey into the Navy during Jackson's presidency. When John Schroeder was the class of 1957 chair of Naval Heritage at the Naval Academy, we discussed his own related work 2 decades before. John suggested that I pursue the role of Amos Kendall when he was the 4th auditor of the Treasury under Jackson. This investigation yielded highly enlightening information, and I am deeply grateful to John for his work, suggestions, and support. Thank you also to Gene Smith and Randy Papadopoulos for their encouragement. I had previously touched upon the 1830s in my first book about Commodore Charles Stewart, as well as an article in Naval Institute Proceedings about the ship of the line USS Pennsylvania launched in 1837. Teaching at the U.S. Naval Academy also provided an opportunity to research in a library full of incredibly talented staff, such as Barbara Manville, and rich in materials. I delved into 2 treasure troves that had rarely been mined. As a former staffer to 2 U.S. senators, I remembered the Center for Legislative Archives at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. Historical debates on the floor of the House and Senate are available at most large libraries, and even online. But those represent only a portion of the policy-making process. The Center holds the records of the committees that considered legislation before it reached the floor. To this end, the files from the House and Senate Naval Affairs Committees were extremely valuable. The second source instrumental to portions of this work were the court-martial records of that era. As I read through 16,000 pages of more than 300 courts-martials, Jackson appeared again and again in approving, denying, or modifying verdicts. I had neither sought nor expected to find this, but this courts-martial revealed a social aspect of the Navy life aboard the ships at sea or in port, studies of interactions with other navies and cultures, the conditions of the ships, and the character of the men who commanded them or sailed them. It was with this information and data analysis that I could show a different side of the Navy and of Jackson as Commander-in-Chief, or rather, Judge-in-Chief. With those and other sources, I have with this work attempted to fill a gap in the study of Jackson's presidency. I do so not as a contrarian to the corpus of all the incredible Jackson biographers to whom we are all grateful, but to inform the literature of the period, namely of the Navy's role during this period. I must be, and am, enriched by conversations I have had with the 3rd individual to influence this work, Williamson Wick Murray, Professor Emeritus at Ohio State University, one of this era's most prolific military historians who became a mentor and friend. His guidance, perspectives, and support for this work were instrumental through the nearly decade-long process of answering the question at the heart of this work. Wick, I learned more about military strategy and history, eating pizza and drinking scotch in your basement, than any course. You were the one who encouraged and sometimes demanded that I return to pursuing a doctoral dissertation even at a later stage in my career. You were there every step of the way, offering advice, discussing and debating my findings, encouraging me to pursue new paths, sharing a laugh, showing and explaining your military models to me, and telling me not to quit more times than I can count. Thank you. Finally, I am deeply grateful to the University of Alabama Press, which published this work. Its acquisition editor, Dan Waterman, was a delight to work with. His steady hand throughout the process was greatly appreciated. My editor, Susan Harris, did what all editors do best, make the end product much better than what they received. Thanks to both of you.